Benvenuti ad Alma Lectio, il podcast dell'Università di Bologna dedicato alle Lectio Magistralis tenute da scienziati, intellettuali e personaggi illustri che nel corso degli anni sono stati invitati dall'Università di Bologna a condividere il loro sapere e contribuire alla divulgazione della conoscenza. Nella puntata di oggi ascoltiamo Sandra Diaz, biologa argentina specializzata in ecologia di comunità ed ecosistemi. Plants, Phenospecies and People, la sua Lectio Magistralis, tenuta il 17 maggio 2024 in occasione del conferimento del dottorato di ricerca ad honorem in Scienze della Terra, della Vita e dell'Ambiente dell'Università di Bologna. Buon ascolto!
Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to start with my most sincere thanks to the rector of the University of Bologna, Professor Giovanni Molari, to the head of the Department of Biological and Geological and Environmental Sciences, Professor Elena Fabri, to the proponent of my PhD ad honorem and admired colleague, Professor Alessandro Chiarucci, to all authorities and to all of you who have come here today to this wonderful ceremony. I have a confession to make. Since my very early childhood, I always had this passion for knowledge, not as a way to make money or to get success in life, not necessarily to make the world a better place, just knowledge for its own sake and pleasure. And I'm afraid is not ameliorating at all with time. If anything, it gets worse with time, like an addiction. Because of that, being here today at one of the world's beacons of knowledge, at the oldest university in Europe and the oldest in continuous operations in the world, is for me an honor beyond words. Today, I will be talking about living nature, and more specifically about plants. But I would like to start with an animal that is important to this university and is also highly relevant to some of the major points I will try to do today. The animal in question is l'ornitorrinco, a major metaphor in Umberto Eco's work, an animal which looks like a random mixture of parts of other animals stitched together, to the point that when the Europeans saw it for the first time, they thought it was a fabrication, one of these chimeras you can see in the Palazzo Poggi. Now, Umberto Eco liked the ornitorrinco as a metaphor for problems that help connecting vastly different domains. But why other people are so fascinated by this animal? Over the whole history of human intellectual interest in nature, all the way from the romantic naturalists to today's social media, what people tend to appreciate the most in nature is the unusual, the exquisite difference, the endless variety. So over the development of the natural sciences, there's always been this tension between, on the one hand, the collectors of details, rare examples and exceptions, and on the other hand, the lumpers, those who seek the very simple, very few general rules underpinning all this fantastic baroque complexity. And in the case of plants, this tension has been far from trivial, because one cannot treat each plant species as an identical point, like a physicist would do with the molecules of a gas, because every single species of plant is slightly different from the rest of the species. But on the other hand, one cannot treat each species as a unique case, because there are simply too many of them. So what is one to do? In our case, and I openly confess that I'm definitely in the Lampers group, what we did is to go for the most fundamental aspects in the life of any plant. So we went for growth, survival, and reproduction. Every single plant on the planet needs to do these three in order to persist. So we embark in this brutal simplification exercise to try to identify those physical features of plants that would capture these essential dimensions of being alive. We just wanted the minimum possible of number of these features. So we settled for 6 functional traits, which are very simple, but at the same time, they are fundamental for every plant on Earth. And we put together a database that is the biggest in the planet of these functional traits at the level of species. Big as it is, the data set only covers just above 10% of the vascular plant species known to science. But we managed to cover all the inhabited continents and the most extreme values of these fundamental traits. So, for example, when talking about plant height, we covered all the way from Lenticchia d'acqua, 1 millimeter, to the sequoia, almost 100 meters. And when talking about reproductive structures, we covered all the way from the microscopic spores of ferns to the seed of Coco di Mare, which weighs 20 kilograms. And the same for all these 6 fundamental traits. Now, what did we do with all this information? I'm sure you are all familiar with maps and know how to locate any place on Earth on geographical space using the 3 geographical coordinates: longitude, latitude, and altitude above sea level. Now, for a minute, imagine a different space, a functional space rather than a geographical one. And instead of 3 dimensions, 6 dimensions, 1 dimension per each of these fundamental plant traits. This space is what we call the global plant phenospace. And one can ask what part of the potential theoretical global plant phenospace is actually occupied by the plants that are living today on Earth. So, if every possible combination of these fundamental traits were possible, so for example, if I could combine any leaf size with any seed size with any stem density, then the global phenospace of plants would be a hypercube, a cube in 6 dimensions, or perhaps a hypersphere. But this is how the real observed global phenospace looks like. Of course, I cannot show it to you in all its 6-dimensional glory. I can only show you 3 dimensions at a time. What is really interesting about this phenospace is that it's very different from a hypercube or even a hypersphere. This is because it's very constrained, suggesting that only a very limited number of essential plant lifestyles, a very limited number of combinations of these six fundamental traits are successful and therefore common. Many combinations of these traits are either don't exist or are very rare. So, however much Umberto Eco and us love the ornithorhynchos, nature doesn't like them and seems to tolerate them only as exceptions. Indeed, nature hates plant ornithorhynchos so much that we were able to simplify the global plant phenospace even further. We applied a very common simplification technique, principal component analysis, and we found that 3/4 of the total variation of plants in this multidimensional space was captured by just one plane. This plane, which we call the global spectrum of plant form and function. This plane has two major dimensions. One is a dimension of size of the whole plant and size of the organs of the plant. And it goes all the way from tiny plants with tiny seeds and leaves to tall plants with big leaves and seeds, such as Noche del Brasile. And the other major axis of variation in this plane is about pace of life, is about resource economy. And it goes all the way from highly conservative plants that devote resources mostly to defense and support rather than growth. They grow slowly, they live a long time. Examples, the agrifolio or ginepro. And at the other end of this size of variation are plants that are very acquisitive, full of nitrogen. They devote resources mostly to growth. They live fast and die young, such as basilico. This is the first global picture of essential functional diversity of vascular plants. Of course, it's a multidimensional phenospace, but it's rather flat and is slightly tilted and is very granular with very dense and very non-dense areas. Pretty much like the galactic plane of the Milky Way. Or if you are not particularly inclined to astronomical metaphors, it looks like a piece of flat bread. Now, let me show you some illustrations of plants that are located at the fringes of the global spectrum so you have a better mental picture of what is where. Indeed, plant life on Earth, despite its exquisite variety, seems to follow some simple common patterns that can be effectively summarized by a highly stylized, a highly simplified phenospace. So the next immediate question is, hang on a minute, isn't this phenospace just too simplistic? Is it making justice to plant diversity on Earth, or are we going too far with the simplification? The answer depends on your objectives. Of course, if there is a very specific question about a very specific group of plants, this phenospace would be far too simplistic, far too sketchy. But on the other hand, the global spectrum of plant form and function is like a functional mapamundi that captures the essential design of any plant, and the trajectory of any plant entity on the planet with just two quantitative coordinates. Of course, it doesn't capture everything that is important to a plant, but capture things that are important to all vascular plants. In a way, it's like different approaches to painting. This is a highly hyper-realistic version of a horse by Caravaggio. It makes full justice to that particular horse. You can almost see jumping from the surface. And on the other hand, this is Picasso's version of a horse. It doesn't make any justice at all to any particular horse. But everyone in the planet would recognize this as a horse because it captures all the essential features of all the horses that live today. So, in a way, the global spectrum of plant form and function is a picture of plant life on Earth painted a la Picasso. Now, this global phenospace, this shape, is just a snapshot. It's just a picture, a static picture of what is a process in constant change. So our next question was, what about the shaping and reshaping of this shape over time? And more specifically, how are humans reshaping the global plant phenospace? We have been deeply entangled with plants since our very origins. People get myriad essential contributions from plants. Plants form the vast proportion of the food and fuel for all life on Earth, including us. They regulate the climate, they distribute water on the planet, they underpin almost every aspect of human health, they provide the basis of our economies, the inspiration for most of our discoveries, and the stories and images that form our identity as unique individuals and as members of distinct cultural traditions. We wouldn't be ourselves without plants. We simply wouldn't be without them. And indeed, all the drama of the human social history of at least the past 1,000 years, with all its progress and all its tragedy, could be told through the plants that mediated the interactions between very different groups of people. Think, for example, of clove, of opium poppies, of precious wood, sugarcane, cotton, rubber, coffee, oil palm, potatoes, and many more. And this entanglement goes both ways. We've been deeply affecting plant life on Earth. And this influence got much stronger and much more extensive in the past 200 years, and especially in the past 50 years. One of the human impacts on nature most known to the general public is the fact that we cause global extinction of species. And plants are no exception. This is the extinction rate of plants only before the advent of humanity, and this is the present extinction rate, 500 times higher. But how are these extinctions happening? If we were impacting different functional neighborhoods, different areas of the global spectrum of plant form and function equally or randomly, then the global phenospace would get poorer, but not necessarily would dramatically alter its shape. Alternative, if we were affecting some areas of the spectrum much more than others, then we could be causing dramatic reshaping of the phenospace. As I just said, plants are in trouble. About 40% of vascular plants on Earth are estimated to be threatened with extinction to some degree. But this general and very worrying number obscures the fact that some kinds and groups of plants are much more in trouble than others. And we wanted to understand why. So we tried to locate these different groups of plants on the global spectrum of plant form and function. And we found a pattern. The pattern suggests that plant groups that are restricted to some particular neighborhoods of the spectrum are more in trouble than those plant groups that have a high functional diversity. So, for example, the cycads are a very ancient lineage of slow-growing plants, typical of areas with low human disturbance, are very confined to one little neighborhood in the global spectrum, and they are very threatened. On the other hand, the legumes are a huge group, and they show all sorts of lifestyles extending almost all over the spectrum, and they are much less in trouble than other groups. And this is not an artifact of the legumes being just a lot of plants, a lot of species, because the orchids, which are even more numerous than the legumes, are confined to a tiny neighborhood in the global spectrum, about there, and they are considerably more threatened than other groups. Another line of evidence. This is, again, the profile of the global spectrum, and these are the plants we find interesting enough to cultivate them or to help them getting everywhere in the world and in some cases becoming invasive. They have all sorts of lifestyles, but they are differentially occupying the upper region of the global spectrum. And we don't seem to have a lot of interest on the lower region. And then we concentrated a bit more, we just zoomed in on the upper region of the spectrum, and we find that most of the plants we have been using for thousands of years for food, for having fun, for killing each other. Most of the weeds we see every day around our house and our gardens are all there confined to a very small, specialized neighborhood spectrum, what I call the northwest corner, the corner of very acquisitive plants that live fast and die young. Not only that, not only we are making things really easy for them, we have been producing hundreds and hundreds of varieties of them, pushing the limits of the global spectrum towards increasing acquisitiveness. We seem to have this long-term passion with nitrogen and fast growth. The other side of the coin is the plants that are having trouble in our presence. So here, I plotted the different categories of plants according to the red list of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature onto the spectrum. And you can see that the least concerned plants, the plants have no problem at all, are everywhere, all sorts of lifestyles. But the threatened and near threatened plants are significantly clustered toward the southeast corner, a corner of plants which are mostly woody, tough. They live long, but they grow slowly, and therefore they recover very slowly from disturbance. And this corner is also a highly unpopulated region of the global spectrum in our geological era. Comparatively, very few living plants occupy that neighborhood. So, it seems that our entanglement with plant life on Earth is highly heterogeneous across the phenospace, using very different sectors of the phenospace for different purposes, and focusing our attention and care much more on some sectors than others, and imposing threats deliberately or as collateral damage on very specific areas of the phenospace. In other words, as well as being a random extermination role, we also have this longer-term, subtler role. We have been gardening for some groups of plants and gardening against some other groups of plants with very specific positions on the global plant phenospace. So, if a second flood were to come, and I were the captain of the ark, I would first try to let every single species on Earth onto the ark. But if the ark proved too small, then I wouldn't let species in at random. The species in the northwest corner, the acquisitive plants that live fast and die young, don't seem to have any trouble at all in our presence. They can take very good care of themselves. So I would give priority to the opposite corner. I would give priority to the slow-living, beautiful losers in the world we have created. Grazie.
Avete ascoltato Plants, Phenospaces and People, la Lectio Magistralis di Sandra Diaz, tenuta il 17 maggio 2024 in occasione del conferimento del dottorato di ricerca ad honorem in Scienze della Terra, della Vita e dell'Ambiente dell'Università di Bologna. Vi aspettiamo alla prossima Alma Lectio.